This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by GiftTrek.net. You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 52, Klingon Love Machine Guide. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including LeVar and JJ at WWDC, TCA awards nominations for Shatner and TOS, video game Gorn, glue guns and phasers, movie news and rumors, and we welcome our new sponsor, GiftTrek.net. Then in the feature, we're joined by Larry Nemechek to talk about the Voyager episode, Prophecy. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing very well, mainly because I'm wearing my serious hat, which is going to help me be very serious today. Our listeners can't see it. Hopefully you'll have a link somewhere. I'm going to be very serious today in my bright orange serious hat.
I think we can put a link up somewhere. Yeah. You do seem very serious today, Greg. Although I have to say that Q mustache that you have going there from Q-less is distracting me a little bit. It's kind of... I can't connect there. The mustache and the serious hat. It's just a little bit odd.
I must have missed that staff meeting where we discussed that the Q from Q-less mustaches were going to become mandatory. How exactly did that come about?
Well, it is a new show policy. In order to participate in the Ready Room, you must grow a mustache like the one Q has during the fight scene from Q-less. I'm trying to do a DS9 rewatch, and I was working my way through season one last week. And
I'm sorry.
That scene came on, and I just thought, you know, that mustache is really happening, and we really should have those when we record the show, because I think it would just raise the excitement level amongst everyone on the panel, and we'll just take the Ready Room to a new level. So,
All right. So it's sort of like the new Ready Room uniform. Rather than having, you know, red and blue and yellow and badges, we just have the Q mustache.
Right, yeah, just the Q mustache the serious hats and nothing else.
Well, I'm working on distributing the serious hats to everyone because, really, this podcast has been a little too silly, so I'm trying to move it back towards serious. I think you're going to see a marked difference this week.
Okay, well, let's find out. All right, so how's everything else going over there in Seattle?
Oh, it's great. It's bright. It's sunny. My film is coming along. I'm working on a new podcast. I'm working on a music video. Creativity has no bounds here in Seattle. How are things for you?
Well, it's nice you have some sun there in Seattle because we are officially into rainy season in Japan. So it's kind of chilly today and it's raining all the time. Mm-hmm. As you know, in Japanese, it's called tsuyu. And reminds me, I don't know if they still do it, but years ago on Tokyo FM, they used to have Tsuyu Busters, where they took the theme song from Ghostbusters, but they had dun 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 dun, dun Tsuyu Busters. Dun, 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 dun.
Wow.
And then they would have a contest and you can call in and do trivia or something. So it's that time of year.
And then Bill Murray came out with a backpack on and sucked all the rain into a box or something.
Well, probably. I mean, you know, Bill Murray, I mean, he's over here all the time anyway, doing whiskey commercials. So,
as you well know.
So probably. All right. Well, let's hop into our mailbag this week, Greg. Now, we have a couple of letters that we didn't have a chance to read last week. So these refer back to our DS9 show when we covered Emissary. And our first letter is from Rebecca Skipper. And she says, excellent commentary on Emissary. While I agree that Deep Space Nine has more character development and explores some issues on a deeper level, I disagree with the notion that religion is absent from TNG and TOS. The Undiscovered Country Project discusses how spirituality plays a major development in Star Trek, even if it isn't apparent. I argue that the best traits in the Federation reflect the best qualities of our diverse religious traditions. I can see the similarities between Enterprise and Deep Space Nine. I'm convinced that Starfleet may be idealized, but it doesn't mean that all the Trek universe was harmonious, and we see some glimpses of that. How many times did Picard respond to a plague? We aren't exposed to the outside world beyond Picard and his crew. I agree that the journey towards Roddenberry's vision is just as interesting. Enterprise didn't serve as a good prequel series, though it was a wonderful show in its own right. A good prequel would look similar to Deep Space Nine. Sisko, in my view, would have been an excellent captain during Archer's time, though Picard is still my favorite captain. I can't see Janeway or Picard thriving in the 22nd century merely because they didn't live in that era. I wish we could have a series examining the history before First Contact, and a separate series between Enterprise and TOS covering the Romulan War. Thanks again for a great and thought-provoking podcast, and happy anniversary. All right, so I think Rebecca touched on a few points there, Greg.
Yeah, she actually brought up to mind a conversation I was having with someone who's a little new to Star Trek this week. And she was asking me, you know, what is it exactly about Star Trek that really appeals to us? And Rebecca really brought this to mind. And, you know, the thing about religion in Star Trek is that, you know, as I think of it, Star Trek doesn't deal with religion because it's a universe that doesn't think about it. This is a universe, a world that is moved on, is more harmonious just in general. They've incorporated the best parts of religion into, you know, basically secular humanism. And I think this is the world we're moving towards, which is this, you know, utopian world where everyone just gets along because they realize that's the best way to be. And that's really encouraging. And Star Trek is, you know, it's really optimistic. And it's one of the only optimistic sci-fis out there, you know, that actually says in the future, things are going to be better. So that's really encouraging. And I wanted to ask you, Chris, what do you think? What is it about Star Trek, you know, at its core that really appeals to you?
For me, it's being able to talk about social issues through science fiction and, you know, take a deeper look at the problems we face and how we can solve those problems and, you know, do it in a way where it's not always easy to talk about it if we talk about ourselves. So that's not just Star Trek, but it's, you know, science fiction in general. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, religion's a very, very touchy subject.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's difficult to really discuss religion. But through Star Trek, they're able, especially through Deep Space Nine, they're mm-hmm. able to actually examine religion from kind of from the outside looking in, because the religion, it's not our religion, it's the Bajoran religion.
Mm-hmm.
But it has very much a parallel to religion on Earth right now. I do have to say, I have to disagree with Rebecca and actually with Kevin and the Undiscovered Country thing on some of the religious inclusions in TOS and TNG, in that I think that you can certainly look at TOS and TNG and you can find religious references or parallels if you're looking for them. But the difference between those and DS9 is that TOS and TNG made an effort to either steer clear of religion, or when it was presented, it was always presented in a negative form.
Mm-hmm.
That, as we've talked about before, anything that was like a god turned out to be an alien in disguise, right? And I know the prophets turn out to be aliens as well, but the way that DS9 tackles religion is they, from the very beginning, made religion an integral part of that series on the surface. And there was no, you know, couching it in
mm-hmm.
the way the other series did. So I think it's very, very different. I think it's the only Star Trek series that actually integrates religion into the series.
Yeah.
And so that puts it on a kind of a different level there.
And we'll have a talk in a little while, you know, when Larry joins us, talking about religion in Voyager, the Klingon religion. And I'm sure we'll talk about several aspects of that. And that'll be interesting to get to. But yeah, I don't feel like the Klingon religion was ever treated, well, I don't know. It's sort of on the same level, but there was something different, yeah, about the way that DS9 approached it. Sisko was very much turned around on it, from going from saying, this is dumb, I'm going to ignore it, to making it a part of his life, which is, something Picard, I just don't see him ever doing that. And certainly, you know, Janeway as well. And certainly Kirk was never going to be turned to believing in another culture's gods.
Exactly. I think the difference is that the Klingon religion, when it's presented very much as mythology. The whole idea of Kalos, it's like Greek mythology or something. There's this god that's there. But the Bajoran religion is different. It's not presented. It's not presented as mythology any more than, say, Christianity is mythology now. For the Bajorans, it wasn't a mythology. It functioned as a complete parallel to the way that Earth religions function today. And so that was a big difference between the Bajorans and what we saw, little bit we saw of the Klingon religion over the course of the series. So anyway, it's a very interesting topic, and it's one that can create a lot of debate. I do find what the Undiscovered Country Project is doing very interesting. And one of the great things about Star Trek is that each person can see something different in Star Trek. And so you can look at any given episode and you can find what it means to you and what the message is and how it inspires you or influences you. And that's why Star Trek's been around for 45 years. And, you know, as Doug and Jose said when we had them on a few weeks ago, you know, they expect it'll always be around. As long as our civilization is around, there will be Star Trek in some form. So... So it goes on. So thanks for your letter, Rebecca. Very thought-provoking, and we're glad that you're enjoying this show as well. And Greg, we have one more letter here. This is from our friend Renee Roberts Mares, who sent us the Klingon birthday clip for our show a couple of weeks ago. And she says, "Dear Chris and Greg, glad you enjoyed the Klingon birthday clip. I loved your review of Emissary. I'm certain I will listen to it again and again. DS9 is my favorite Star Trek series, and Emissary was an excellent pilot that established an incredible number of issues and characters, and laid the groundwork for the rest of the series. You guys brought out so many gems that I cannot touch on them all in an email. Matt and Ben were wonderful guests, too. I hope you get one or both of them on again soon. Here's to another 12 months of fantastic shows. So in the truest sense, live long and podcast. Trademark Colin." Cheers, Mares. Okay. All right. So as always, Renee's one of our biggest supporters by email, letting us know what she thinks about each show. So thanks for the letter, Renee. And we're glad that you enjoyed our talk about DS9 as well.
Yes, thank you. I can't wait to get back to DS9 in another month and a half or however long it is.
Right. You did tell me now you wanted to do Move Along Home next, right?
I'm actually considering a series of Move Along Home stories, you know. Each one will be for, you know, one of the Shaps. We're going to do a whole discussion of what the hopscotch sequence means in the grander scheme. I don't know if you realize the parallels between Star Trek III. TOS is Day of the Dove. TNG is The Inner Light. And the hopscotch scene from Move Along Home. There's actually some very deep parallels that I'll be getting into in part one of our Move Along Home arc.
Yes. Yeah, it was very nuanced and very deep and intricate.
And I think a lot of first time and second time and third time and, you know, up to eighth time viewers are really going to miss a lot of that subtlety that I think we can really bring to the fore.
I think so. So everyone, please tune in to our three-part Move Along Home arc. Is it going to be three parts, Greg, or did you
say
more than three?
I think there were three Shap. Well, no, you start on the second Shap, and you go to the fifth. I don't really remember.
All right. Well, it's going to be a marathon, so just, you know.
Yes, stay
grab
tuned.
Some popcorn, grab some beer, and settle in for a night of Move Along Home with the Ready Room. And I'll make sure Greg's wearing a serious hat for that show as well, so.
I think they all should have been wearing their serious hat while in the game world to remind everyone how serious that episode really was.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's move on into news this week, Greg. What do we have up first?
Well, we have some interesting news coming out about this week's Worldwide Developer Conference, or WDC, from Apple. You know, it's in the news mainly because Apple will probably be announcing a whole lot of new gadgets that I'm going to want to purchase. I know you need another Mac Pro, right, Chris?
the mythical Mac Pro upgrade.
Yes. One of these years.
I don't know. I kind of have a feeling that the Mac Pro is at the end of its life. I think we might get one more upgrade on that with a couple of new, you know, Thunderbolt and a few things. And then I think that that might be the end of the road for the Mac Pro, unfortunately.
It's very possible. But so there's all of that that we will talk about in our Mac podcast later this week. But that doesn't exist. But there's a Star Trek something or another going on there as well that I saw. It's that LeVar Burton and J.J. Abrams will actually be doing WWDC sessions.
This was interesting. This just kind of came out of the blue. Now, when I first saw it, I thought, well, of course, they're going to try to push Final Cut Pro 10, I'm sure. It's probably what's going on because, you know, Adobe has gained some ground on Apple over the past year after the premature release of Final Cut Pro 10, which I use, by the way, for those of you who watch Hyper Channel, that's all done in Final Cut Pro 10. And it really was released a bit prematurely. And so Apple has to kind of make up a bit of ground, I think, on Adobe. And what better way to do that than to pull in J.J. Abrams and LeVar Burton for sessions?
Right. But are they, I don't think they're ending up really talking about the filmmaking side of things. And that's what's really interesting about this.
Well, they're talking about technology and storytelling, making a difference in the digital age. But
I guess they might touch on it. But it looks like wider, like broad topics.
But you know, Apple, they don't.
Yeah.
They come at things from angles. You know, they're not gonna hit you over the head with with the software itself. I really have a feeling this is how the way they've promoted Final Cut in the past is by having filmmakers tell their stories.
Right. Right.
And so I have a feeling that that's where this is headed. Now, I could be wrong. It could be something. I mean, maybe they have they're going to have a new. Maybe the reason that the Apple on the WWDC invite is rainbow colored is that they have a new Reading Rainbow Apple crossover thing going. I don't know.
Wow. That's what's in the news. There's a Reading Rainbow app coming out for the iPad.
Developed. But I'm talking about like deep integration in iOS, you know, like Twitter integration.
I see. Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. Like you're looking at a website and you want to publish it to Reading Rainbow.
You could do that or anything. You know, in Safari, you have the reader function where you can click reader and it'll bring it up like a piece of paper. In the new one, in the tie-in, what I think it is that any article that you are reading online, if you click reader, it'll have an option. It doesn't say reader anymore. It says Reading Rainbow. And when you tap it, LeVar Burton will actually read the article to you. Anything on the internet can be read to you by Mr. Jordy LaForge.
That's really fantastic. Now, will this lead to more advances in Jordy apps? I mean, we got the Reading Rainbow app. I'm assuming we're going to have the Find a Girlfriend on the Holodeck app. And, of course, we're going to have the Barrel Roll app.
Well, I would just say that if you are going to use the Barrel Roll app, make sure that you have a really sturdy case on your iPhone or your iPad, because as you tumble across the floor, you're going to want to make sure you don't damage that expensive gadget that you have there. But I'm definitely downloading the Barrel Roll app the moment it's available. I'm even going to put it in my dock.
All right. So LeVar will be talking about basically his efforts to educate and enlighten using Apple products. JJ is going to be talking about how he uses Apple products basically in this prosumer gadgetry to do things his way. And of course, I hope he'll be talking about the Enterprise Bridge, which basically looks like an Apple store itself right there on the Enterprise.
So how does JJ use the Apple products now? Does he use Siri and say things like, Siri, give me new ways to deny that Cumberbatch is playing Khan.
Searching for Siri, give me new ways to deny that Cumberbatch is playing card.
She's not very helpful.
Is that how it's used? I don't know.
Well, what they discovered over the course of the last movie, if you shine bright spotlights from behind the camera, and then you have interns, not with spears, like on the original series, but instead interns with iPads. They sort of rotate the iPad and the reflective surface shines back into the camera. Little known fact, all of the lens flares in the film were actually caused by Apple products reflecting light back towards the camera. There's some great behind-the-scenes footage of JJ sort of wobbling an iPad. You've got Roberto Orci sort of waving his iPhone in the air. It's not how you think of Apple products being used.
Right.
But it's surprisingly effective.
Well, it is. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, when Samsung or these other companies, when they advertise their smartphone devices or their tablets on television, they always talk about what kind of processor and how much memory it has. But Apple shows you, like, just how these things can be used in your everyday life. And that's a perfect example. I mean, that's you would never think of using the device in that way, but yet it works. And so I would just like to remind everyone that this scenario was just brought up by the guy who's wearing his serious hat today. Now, the guy who promised you that the show would not be nearly as silly this week as it usually is. So good job, Greg.
Thank you.
You're doing really well.
If you're going to WWDC, to learn how to be a, Apple developer and see the new products, please go to LeVar and JJ Sessions and please feel free to ask JJ, what the best way to create lens flares with your iPad is.
Yeah. That's going to be really cool.
I'm
hoping they will put the footage of this on their website, on the Apple website afterwards, so that we can actually see it. All right. Well, moving along, Greg, another interesting story this week is that even though the series came out in 1967, the original series and William Shatner are nominated this year for a TCA award. That's the Television Critics Association Awards.
Very cool. Yeah, I've heard of these awards. They're a group of journalists, right? I mean, this is sort of like the Golden Globes are done by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
That's right, yeah.
So this is done by journalists across all media who talk about television. And I think they mainly give awards to new, new things, right? Like, it's sort of like the Emmys.
Well, I think they do. Well, they have different categories. So what this one is called the Heritage Award. And
right.
So I guess this goes to, series that have had an impact on entertainment, I would suppose, because the last five winners of this award were in 2007, The Sopranos won. So that's a fairly recent show. I mean, what's that, 10 years ago? When did The Sopranos start?
Well, yeah.
Early Sopranos, 2000s?
Yeah, it must have been early 2000s. It ended just a few years ago, so it's still a pretty modern show.
But towards the end, between the last season and the next to last season, didn't they go on like a JJ film schedule where they had like 4-year gap or something like that?
Did they? I never really followed The Sopranos. It wouldn't surprise me.
It wasn't 4 years, but there was like a delay getting the final season or the final episode.
That makes sense. So
I'm just kidding. 2008 was The Wire. 2009 was ER. But in 2010, the award went to MASH, which of course is quite an old show. And in 2011, it went to The Dick Van Dyke Show. So,
right, so they're just looking to award it to something that they feel had a huge impact and that we really should be thinking about today, even though it may be an old show, it may be a new show, but it's, what they think just should be thought about and should be given an award right now.
Right.
For whatever
Which makes
reason.
Me wonder, I mean, the reasoning, it all makes sense, but it makes me wonder, the nominees this year are the original series, Twin Peaks, Saturday Night Live, Cheers, and Lost. But based on what you're saying, I really have to wonder why Bosom Buddies is not in here.
Bosom Buddies is one of those classics, often forgotten, but, what with the important things in the news related to Bosom Buddies that's going on this year that caused them to be constantly brought up by you on the show... It makes perfect sense for one of these awards to be given to that seminal 80s classic.
So everyone, I get an iMessage from Greg, I think yesterday, and he said, I'm listening to the Ready Room 10. I guess you were just going back to kind of compare, where the show was and how we've evolved it. And he goes, Did you ever realize how often you bring up bosom buddies?
You really do. And I it still kind of comes out of nowhere. I'm starting to think you need to, you know, like we have with Battlestar Galactica, we need to find a bosom buddies sound clip to insert.
So say we all.
I do. I need a bosom buddy sound clip. Okay, I'm going to get on that right now.
All right.
All right. So anyway, TOS is up for this award, and in addition, William Shatner is up for the Career Achievement Award. Now, I don't think William Shatner is going to win this award this year, probably because the nominees are Dick Clark, Andy Griffith, David Letterman, and Regis Philbin, and I'm pretty sure Dick Clark is going to win the award this year, given that he passed. And he's very, very deserving. I mean, Dick Clark has done... William Shatner has done many, many things for entertainment as well. But, I mean, if you think about all the things that wouldn't exist if Dick Clark had not been involved, it's incredible. Right. So I do expect Dick Clark will win the Career Achievement Award. But I do think TOS has a great shot at winning the Heritage Award. So we will find out. The ceremony will be July 28th. And we'll find out if they win.
Very cool. And of course, William Shatner, one of his most important film roles was when he defeated that Gorn on Cestus 3.
Yes. Wasn't that,
which leads us to our next news story, which is related to, I don't know, is this the season of conferences? Because we're having WDC next week, and then this past week was E3 in California.
Yeah, I guess it is the season of conferences.
So a lot of video game news coming out, and of course, news about the new Star Trek game that's based on the JJ-verse. And what was revealed, as I'm teasing it, was the villain, which of course is the Gorn. Right now, you're excited about this? You're excited about this, Chris? Do you want to team up with Spock and blast some lizards?
Well, I think it would be fun. Especially with something like Kinect on the Xbox or PlayStation Move, I think it would be fun to reenact the fight scene from Arena.
Yes.
Unfortunately, in the screenshots that have been released, this Gorn looks like the Gorn from Enterprise, from Intermirror Darkly. And
yeah, which means they might actually be capable of causing physical harm to you.
Right.
Unlike the one from the original series.
Because the Gorn on Cestus 3, I mean, the nice thing about that is that you had time to plot your next move.
Yes.
But with the Gorn that we saw in Enterprise, that would be more like, you know, fighting a crocodile or fighting a T-Rex. You really don't have time as they prepare to swing at you and get themselves in position to make the slow motion swing. You don't have time, you know, to plan your next move. So, I don't know. It's nice to see them bringing back a classic villain like the Gorn.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how happy a lot of fans are going to be that it is this kind of full-on CGI kind of. It's kind of like when they redid Godzilla in, was that 1998 when the new Godzilla movie came out, and they just completely changed Godzilla, and he wasn't cheesy anymore.
I love the Roland Emmerich Godzilla fan, and I know it has its fans, but yeah, most, you know, real Godzilla fans, you know, they refer to it as Godzilla name only, the Gina.
Yeah.
And yeah, those people really hate it. So, yes, I imagine there's going to be a lot of hate for this. But, you know, if it's a good game, you know, there's also that Star Wars 1313 that's coming out, you know, eventually for next-gen consoles. And that looks amazing. So, I'm feeling good right now about what's going on with you know, the Star Wars, Star Trek video games. What I've seen of this so far is good. And if it plays well, if it's fun, I hope people aren't put off by the fact that they're not, you know, slow moving, you know.
Yeah,
I don't cardboard think rocks.
I don't think anyone will really care, but yeah, the game footage that we've seen looks fantastic.
Yeah.
It looks like it's going to be a great game. I do hope it's multiplayer so that we can get on PlayStation together and finally play something.
Are you going to be? It does have co-op. Now, are you going to be Kirk? Or are you going to be Spock? Or are you going to be Uhura, who basically just runs in and hugs Spock whenever he gets hurt?
Yeah, I'm going to play the Uhura role. I'm going to let you do all the fighting, and anytime you get hit by anything, I'll just run in with my Uhura character and I will hug your Spock character. There's also the special bonus mode. It's, you know, they like to put Easter eggs in video games. There is the mode where you can play as a Glommer.
Oh, very nice. Now, Glommers, they dispatch Gorn very easily, so that'll be fun to see.
Indeed. So we'll keep our eyes open for news about this. Hopefully the game will come out sometime. I think now it's slated for a spring 2013 release.
Right.
It's starting to get to be like a Microsoft operating system where they talk about it for 7 years before they ever release it. But hopefully it will come out on schedule. Looking forward to that.
Next year is going to be a huge, you know, huge as far as pushing Star Wars, Star Trek, and pushing that JJ verse. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this game and then seeing the movie, and looking forward to 2013.
Absolutely. Now, another interesting thing came up, came to my attention this week. And of course, you know Mary Serwinski, and she's Televixen on Twitter, and she had her Make Me Daner campaign. And she co-hosts the podcast DVD Geeks as well. And Mary and Brandi Clark have teamed up now to do a new video blog called Glue Guns and Phasers. I think Mary actually did last year at Star Trek Las Vegas, did a crafting session along these lines. And now they're doing a video blog. And they're going to be doing another crafting session at Star Trek Las Vegas this year. And in the first episode of this, Greg, they took Scrabble tiles and they printed little Star Trek imagery, you know, cut them out and made necklaces or pins or magnets, making little trinkets using Scrabble tiles. So it was very interesting. And they did use glue guns to do it. Now, they didn't do it like Sulu would have just used a phaser. He would probably just heated up the tile and then let it cool and melt the imagery onto the tile. But they used glue guns, which is a little bit easier to obtain at your local Home Depot.
Yeah, I watched this video. It looked very cool. I don't know how much I'm in need of Star Trek tiles, but it looked like something I could handle. It definitely did. I believe they said this is Ensign level. So even Harry Kim could manage to take Scrabble tiles and glue gun some Star Trek imagery onto it.
Not only that, but if you go down to Starfleet Academy today, you could take this course with Ensign Harry Kim. And the amazing thing is that if you go into the future, maybe 60 years from now, Ensign Harry Kim will still be at Starfleet Academy teaching this Ensign level course.
Oh, goodness. Now, are they going to upgrade? Is there maybe going to be a lieutenant and then commander and then captain and then admiral level? I mean, I'm thinking admiral, maybe you get to design your own admiral uniform.
I'm pretty sure that's what all the admirals do. They all design their own uniforms. Once you do that, you also get to design your own belt buckle to go with your admiral uniform. So
nice.
I was wondering what an acting ensign level project might be like.
That's just the Scrabble tile.
It's
You get to look at it, turn it around in your hand.
Yeah. I see. So this is going on. I did want to ask you, Greg, though. Now, we don't know what the next crafting project is going to be. Now, if you were to create your own crafting projects, what would you make?
Wow, that's a very good question. What would I create as far as Star Trek crafting? I don't know. That is a very good question. I mean, obviously, an admiral's uniform would be difficult. Wow, this is catching me off guard. I have my Sirius hat now, and I'm really starting to think of other hats I could create. And, you know, we talked last week about the possibility of there being hats in the new Star Trek movie. What if we created a set of next generation hats? You know, one for command level, one for, you know, science, and then, you know, blue one. I think this could be really good. I mean, imagine the bridge, but instead of everyone having on, you know, they're bright colored uniforms. They just got a very plain uniform, but a brightly colored hat. And it just says science or command. Across the front in giant letters. I think this is it's a reimagining of the next gen, sure. But I think it's, you know, lieutenant level as far as crafting goes.
Yeah.
I think we should try it out.
That's a great idea. I would love to see all the series remastered with that. So, What would the aliens that you encounter, like, they activate the view screen, they're expecting to see some kind of very official looking, it's the Federation, right? They're
right, right.
And what they see are, like, everyone wearing these brightly colored baseball caps that say science or command. Picard is there with the command across the front. Riker has command. What would Troy's hat say? Obvious?
Mostly useless? I'm not sure.
That would be quite an interesting scene. Okay, well, great idea. Well, so if you're interested in seeing this, everyone, if you go over to Twitter, you can follow Mary and Brandy at username GlueGunsPhasers, GlueGunsPhasers. And you can also find the episode on Mary's YouTube channel, or you can go over to our site at trek.fm and look. We'll have a link in the show notes for this Ready Room. Or if you look in the Hyper Channel News Journal, then you can see the video there as well. So it should be very interesting. Well, Greg, let's take a break from news for just a minute to talk about our new sponsor. I'm very excited that we have a sponsor on the Ready Room now, and this is gifttrek.net, a great site for getting all of your Trek merchandise.
Yeah, and gifttrek.net looks fantastic. If you don't want to make your own Star Trek memorabilia and belt buckles and mugs and all that, they've got a huge selection. And everything from a Lily action figure to a travel mug that says Warp Speed on it. I went to gifttrek.net and I want to buy more and more. It's actually a really fantastic collection of, looks like, new stuff, old stuff, TOS, TNG, Voyager, Enterprise, and movies, anything I could possibly think of. If it's not sold out, it looks like they've got it.
Yeah, that's right. They do have a huge selection of merchandise. And like you said, there's new stuff there, but there's also a lot of collectibles from the past. So if you've been looking for things that you failed to get your hands on at a con or through Star Trek magazine, maybe you saw it there in the past, you can check gifttrek.net and see if they have it in stock. I don't think that they have any life-size Hoshi figures, but... they do
not
have plenty
yet,
of,
but hopefully coming soon.
Maybe, Greg, you can start mass producing those for for gifttrek.net.
But they do have a Spock cookie jar. So you take off Spock's head, remove a cookie as you do. So, you know,
they
if
do,
you're which, looking to find one of those, gifttrek.net is the place to go.
Right, which we talked about that cookie jar back on one of the earlier Ready Rooms, probably right after I talked about Bosom Buddies. I'm not sure. Quite possibly. But a lot of great stuff here. I was looking through the t-shirts, because you know me, mm-hmm. I love my t-shirts. Sometimes I have my Rock, Paper, Scissors, Lizard, Spock t-shirt on as we record the Ready Room. And with all the news recently about the gathering of the five captains, both in Philadelphia, which just happened, and at Star Trek London coming up in October, mm-hmm. I did notice some great t-shirts with all five captains on the front there. So if you want to prepare for your trip to Star Trek London or elsewhere, you can hop over and find that shirt there as well. So
very cool.
Great stuff. I'm looking forward to each week, Greg, looking through here and checking out the merchandise and letting you know what I found that was cool that week.
Now, did our friends at gifttrek.net do they have anything special for our listeners?
Well, actually they do. So if you go over, when you check out, you can use the code TrekFM10. That's TrekFM10, and you can get 10% off of your order. So they already have great prices.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and you can go and save some money as well as you get your Trek merchandise. So so everyone, help support our sponsor, gifttrek.net. And again, that's not .com, that's .net, N-E-T.
Yes.
And help them out and help out the show as well. So we really appreciate their support.
People and they get nasty, something they had and somebody else is holding. Tell
So, Greg, we have kind of a grab bag of rumors this week. You know, as we go along, these things become a little bit less of the rumor category and a little bit more of the fact category, I suppose, although right. we won't really know what's fact until the movie actually comes out next year.
Right. But we have what I think is a really interesting quote from Damon Lindelof, who was one of the writers on the film. I think I just actually want to read the quote. He says, "Kirk is now in the captain's chair for the first time, not having shanghaied it. And he has to learn how to manage his responsibilities as a captain with these friendships and relationships that he's forming with these people around him. And I think also we're introducing what is a very cool and nuanced force of antagonism that's a little different from the first movie, which was just a steaming Romulan ball of rage that needs to be stopped at all costs." Now, wasn't steaming ball of Romulan rage, wasn't that one of our podcast titles a few weeks ago?
It probably was. It sounds like one. I was just thinking, if I were Lindelof, I would be careful using phrases like a steaming ball of something, because there are a lot of longtime Star Trek fans that might take that and twist it around.
Yes, indeed.
About the 2009 movie. But what do you think he means here by a nuanced force of antagonism?
I really have no idea. You know, probably not Harry Mudd. He's not very nuanced. So no. I think we can continue to count Harry Mudd out of things. But yeah, I have no idea what this means. I would actually think it had to do with the whole Vulcan's vengeance storyline if it hadn't already been done in the comics.
Yeah. Well, he did say it was very cool. Now, there was that episode where Spock ended up back in the Ice Age. Was that, do you think it's a reference? Do you think he's like being literal here, that it's very...
That's possible.
Maybe crystalline entity from Next Generation coming back in time.
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think things like having Spock and Uhura be in a relationship was kind of a nuanced force of antagonism toward a lot of original series fans on the part of J.J. Abrams and so forth. Now, maybe they have something else, like maybe Scotty is going to start dating Nurse Chapel in the next movie.
Oh, I can see that. All right. Yeah, who else could we put together? Chekhov could start dating... Daner, Chekhov and Daner. That seems like a match made in heaven.
And therefore the movie's going to be called Star Trek Robbing the Cradle. Is that right?
Well, Daner's also going to be very young in the reboot, so it makes more sense.
Well, maybe. Yeah. I guess so.
She's sort of a wait, what is her role on the ship?
She was just like a research scientist. She was studying ESP in humans, I guess.
Right. So she, you know, she's in this version of it, she's a very young studier of ESP. And so, yeah, just put them right together.
I see. I thought maybe she was a young linguist who was studying foreign language acquisition and how Russians learn English as a second language. So she was getting closer to Chekhov. He thinks as a love interest, but actually she just wants to find out how that language acquisition works in different situations, not only bridge situations or professional ones, but personal ones as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Is she also trying to figure out why he says his W's as V's and is the only Russian ever to have done that? Or his V's as W's. Sorry, I should say that the other way around.
Yeah. I'm sure that's on the list. Yeah. I wonder why. No, it has to be the other way, right?
Yes.
Where do you keep your nuclear vessels?
Your nuclear vessels, yes.
That's right.
In a way that no Russians say. Yeah, I don't know what this means. I am looking forward to more of a next-gen style villain, someone that possibly can be reasoned with. At least you can try to reason with him. Because, every time you try to talk to Nero, it's just, you know, he's going to stab you or, you know, ram into you. Something very bad is going to happen. So, a villain that's more nuanced, more cool, that's definitely what I'm looking for. So it's good to hear Lindelof pointing us in that direction.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what might be coming up in the next movie, Of course, by now most people have probably watched this, but Movie Clips put together a Star Trek II trailer. Interestingly, I noticed on their YouTube channel, the trailer was not actually on their YouTube channel at the time I checked anyway. So even though Movie Clips put this together, I think they didn't say that it was them at first because they just released it as if this were really a trailer. And they duped a lot of people. I mean, apparently they even, someone on Wikipedia like updated the article with information from this trailer as being, this is what the 2013 movie is going to be about.
Yeah, we're going to know in advance when there's a Star Trek trailer coming. It's not just going to leak onto YouTube like this. We're going to know there's a certain movie it's going to be attached to. And yeah, maybe it'll leak, you know, when it first starts showing, but there's not just going to be a version of it showing up on the internet like this. So,
it
is a very cool trailer. I mean, they've cut it together very well. They've, you know, cut different scenes from different movies together to make it. And I mean, this is a thing that studios actually do. There's a trailer going around for the book series Mistborn that was actually created by the people trying to sell Mistborn to movie studios. And it sort of clips from a bunch of other movies cut together as like, this is what the feeling of the movie would be. So that's sort of what we've got here, only it's, yeah, not made by anyone on the production staff, but it is very cool looking.
It is really cool looking. It's really well done. And it made me think that if Khan is coming back, which is what the trailer implies, and if the movie were what we're seeing in the trailer, it could actually be a really cool movie. And I would be fine with the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's all going to be in the way they sell it to us. Yeah. So we're still probably a few months away from an actual teaser trailer. But if your appetite, you know, if you have too much Star Trek appetite, go ahead and watch this trailer because it is very cool. And the shot of Cumberbatch sort of in stasis is, I mean, it's like, oh, cool.
Yeah, that is really cool.
So,
all right. Well, we have one more bit here. Now, this comes from Chris Pine, and he was talking to WGN, the channel in Chicago, about the movie. And he said, obviously, there is something to be said for special effects. We are in the era of the Avengers movie, and people get excited by that stuff. And indeed, the stuff we have in our film is really cool to watch and look at. But what I think is more important, and hopefully what people gravitated to in the first one, are good stories about people. And I think we are capitalizing on the interest people have in these characters and the growth and the journey that these people go on amongst all these crazy special effects. So,
right. It's possible he watched a different 2009 film
That's
than the rest of us.
I was just going to say, I know.
Because, I agree with what he's saying if he's referring to maybe the original series or to some of the original series films. As far as 2009, I don't know which characters and their arcs we were really following.
Right.
I mean, to some extent, sure.
Well, I'm glad to hear him say this, and I hope that what he's saying is that there is a rich, deep, character-driven story in the next movie, because that's what I've been waiting to see and what I've been hoping for.
Exactly.
But at the end of the statement, when he says that he hopes that's what people gravitated to in the first one, like you said, I'm not sure which movie he was watching, because there wasn't much of a story in the first movie.
So
I don't know, but hopefully we're going to get one in this movie. I do hope that this is a sign of that. Right. Obviously, you've got to have the special effects. I mean, that's what's going to draw in the general audience to get them in there first. But hopefully we will get great character moments.
And that's, that is something that the Avengers had, was actual character moments. We actually cared about these characters, even though there's however many Avengers there are in the film. You still managed to care about all of them by the end. So I actually wouldn't mind seeing a Star Trek 2 that's more like the Avengers than the first Star Trek, the first J.J. Star Trek was.
Right. Now, last thing, Greg, before we close out news today, it seems recently that we can't get through a Ready Room without some new thing that Simon Pegg has said during the intervening week. So Peggy has been saying some more things about the new movie. What's he up to now?
Yeah, well, this week he said we're going to see more of the Enterprise, different environments and different ships. Which, that last bit is very interesting because, of course, over the entire course of the original series and even into the first, the motion picture, the only ship we ever saw was, well, the Enterprise or another Constitution-class starship. The whole variety of the Starfleet wasn't revealed. Well, we saw the Reliant, and that was I think that was the only ship for a few movies. Eventually, especially once Next Gen started, we started seeing more variety. The most we probably saw was in First Contact, when we see a lot of different ships on screen. And then, of course, the Dominion War, we start seeing more and more different types of Federation ships.
Yeah, it started branching out. Yeah, through the Next Generation, you would sometimes see a few. You know, of course, there was the Excelsior class, which we got in Star Trek III, I guess. Was that the first time we saw the Excelsior?
That's right. I believe
so. And then they started reusing that model a lot. But yeah, it was later on, especially once they were able to do CGI, that we started really getting that big variety of ships. And yeah, through the original series, you didn't really see much of anything that wasn't Constitution that I can think of.
Yeah. And I mean, we saw a couple different ships before they get all blown up in the 2009 film. Of course, we see the Kelvin before it gets blown up. But as far as seeing the Enterprise out there with other ships, I'm hoping this is leading towards there being some sort of large-scale battle of the sort that we've not really been able to show on screen. I mean, you look at Insurrection, where they were supposed to have a large-scale battle with several Federation ships taking on several... was it the Baku, or were they the good guys?
The Baku were the good guys, so it was the Sona. The Sona were the bad guys.
So there's supposed to be several Sona ships and several Federation ships to have this big, big battle, and that just they didn't have the money for it. So I'm hoping to see something like that come out of this film.
Yeah, they spent all their money on the joystick so that Riker could fly through the briar patch.
Ah, well, you gotta spend money where the director wants you to spend the money.
That's right. All right, but we'll see what comes up here. It will be interesting to see more ships. And of course, the more of the Enterprise part is what we talked about last week with the interconnected sets and being able to see more of what's going on in the ship. Cool. So definitely looking forward to the next movie. Voyager took 7 years to make its way through the Delta Quadrant, and finally, in the final season, we got to see a familiar sight as a whole gaggle of Klingons took over a cargo bay on the ship in the episode Prophecy.
Gaggle.
So we're going to talk about this unusual Voyager episode today, Prophecy, and to do that, of course, Greg is here, and we also have friend of the show, Larry Nemechek, who is one of the writers of the episode and the story that the episode was based upon. So welcome back to the radio room, Larry.
Hi, guys. I was just trying to translate gaggle into Klingon, and I was, you know, gaggle, or something. I don't know.
Something like that. Okay.
Now, Larry, I see you're the only one who actually truly came with your cute mustache today to the show. Oh, you got the
same
memo.
Old mustache that I have. Wait, we're on camera tonight? Oh, no. This is my radio mind's eye. Yes. Very. All right. I'm pulling it down now. Yeah.
So looking good.
Picard never grew a mustache.
Very impressive.
Okay.
It would have been a whole other show if Picard had a mustache, but...
Yeah.
All right, well...
He was supposed to, right? Back when he was going to be French. Supposed to have a mustache.
Yeah,
was it going to curl on the sides?
He was going to have a Jacques Cousteau-ish... Except, wait, Jacques Cousteau didn't have a mustache. Anyway. Jacques Cousteau stocking cap. That's what he was going to have. Forget your ball caps, Greg. He was going to have a stocking cap. Mr. Data, what do you... Okay. We're back to Klingons. come on, prophecy. Here we go.
Yes.
It's the mid-90s again. We're all very straight and boring, and the internet is new. Okay.
Well, prophecy is interesting that finally they found a way to really get Klingons onto Voyager. I guess we had the one with the barge. That came after this, though. Did that come after this? The one with the...
No, that was sixth season.
No, Barge of the Dead was, that was sixth. Yeah, because this is midway through the seventh season. I mean, this is already the 2000s before this actually got made.
This is late. B'Elanna is barefoot and pregnant by now.
That's right.
And married, even. And
she everything. Has to be pregnant for this story to work. So speaking of that,
exactly.
Larry, let's talk about the genesis of this story, because I think you and your wife had come up with this.
Genesis was TNG, Chris. I hate to correct you.
That's where everyone turns into bizarre animals that have no relation to their actual DNA. But
yes,
this story, I believe you and your wife came up with the original story for this, correct?
Yes. And now I have to tell you, I have acquired a reputation here now for dragging on, and you have like these 4-hour podcasts whenever you have me on, right? So just as a public service, and also to protect the future great bestseller, The Making of Prophecy, I'm not going to go into every, in-sea detail tonight, but I'll try to scope it out. I'll probably will anyway, but no, Prophecy began as, it was officially called Untitled Klingon. Now you said seventh season? Okay, let me take you back. I don't know, there's times when I've stopped to think and wonder about this and try to find individual stories, because I know there have been stories that were pitched and bought and developed, but over 2 and 3 and 4 years, there were some infamous things in Next Generations for 2 and 3, 4 years that hung around. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I should claim this or not completely, but it may be that this is one of the longest, if not the longest, gestated story in modern Star Trek history. Because, truth be told, my wife got the job as a temporary fill-in as assistant script coordinator on Voyager when they were casting. And we have great stories from that time. We'd share at cons. But she got to be permanently in, and me working with spin-off things like my Next Generation book, and we had just moved to L.A., and we basically were one of the people that had an open door to come in and pitch. And no one ever sells a story on their first... you come in with 2 or 3 or 4 ideas. No one ever sells a story on your first pitch. And we did, which was kind of shocking. And I want to thank Lolita, Faggio, and everybody else that helped coach us a little bit. I mean, I'd interviewed people talking about pitching, so I knew that. But I was new to L.A. and filmed them and everything. But the thing was, Voyager was a super secret show that had started filming in July on the pilot-ish with all the crazy casting time. And they were supposed to debut in January. So they had the pilot, they got cast, they got through all that drama, they started shooting the first 2 or 3 shows. And we actually pitched this in late November. And, so the show was not on the air yet when we pitched our stories. And we had 2 or 3 really good stories. And we looked at each other and said, okay, well, this is a baby show, an infant show with infant characters, unformed. All they know is what they wrote on the writer's guide and then the first basic 2 or 3 shows. If you think back how first season series always is, the characters are babies. So that's all we had to go on, And in the middle of the 2 or 3 ideas, one of them was Voyager meets up basically with a galactic wagon train of ships and becomes kind of the... strayed cavalry officer that's riding along with them to help them get through bandits and, a tokenly stereotypical Indian raid that we didn't use. But, that was one of our pitches that I really liked. But anyway, so we looked at each other after we came up with 2 or 3 really good stories we worked on and went, okay, so they've got a half Klingon in the show. We ought to pitch the token generational Klingon ship that's in the Delta Quadrant story. just a dumb thing. And, of course, that's the one that, after all the work we put on the other, elaborate shows, that's the one that Jerry said, oh, I like that. So we pitched to Jerry Taylor and, Janet's two steps above boss. And they went, oh, okay. She says, I think I'll pass that along to Michael. So... a couple of weeks later, I'm at home, and and my wife sends me a fax on December 15th, and I'm looking at it right now. I just blanked you guys on my camera. Anyway, it's from Michael to Michael from Jerry, Nemechek pitch, and she just says, Larry and Janet have pitched an idea which seems like a natural. I thought about it maybe too. Seems premature in the first season after they'd done, splitting B'Elanna in two faces. And she basically says what we pitched. It was picking up the signal of a Klingon bird of prey, rendezvousing with them. It's from decades ago. It's Kirk-era Klingons.
And it's Captain Claw, right?
Yes.
That would have been perfect.
Out to shoot at any satellite out of the sky.
He got lost in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah. It was the Klingon with ADD, saw too many shiny things and just kind of got off track a little. And as we said, the idea is to explore Klingon's, B'Elanna's Klingon side. Since she was the Klingon, and one of the things, out of the gate with B'Elanna was, I hate my Klingon side. I don't want to admit to being a Klingon. Mm-hmm. I want to suppress it. So the gist of the story was, that we pitched was that there's a ship, they come across it, it's historic, it's amazing, but it's 100 years old, so they're not near as a technical threat. And B, they envy the Voyager once they figure it out that, oh my God, that really is it. And C, they have no clue about the piece, the Kittimer Accords and the Détente and the Alliance and all that, and they don't believe they'd ever be anything like that. And C, after kind of a battle that Voyager kind of blows them out of the sky, nearly, but of course Janeway is mama captain and she's not about to blow them out of the sky. And they're living relics and all that. If Spock was there, he would have said, Captain, you cannot, these would answer millions of unknown questions about Klingon heritage. Klingon captain agrees to, okay, I see your point, He doesn't believe it for a second, and if he does, all he wants is their ship, and these, squirmy humans will make quick work of them, even if they are from a century beyond us. And so, who gets assigned to liaise between the two ships? But of course, their engineer and B'Elanna. So, and she hates it. She fights Janeway. Janeway makes her do it anyway. And after a while, she finds herself falling for the Klingon and all these Klingon things, and it's working, on her roots. And so she does that, and then somewhere along the way, she finds out that she's being used as a way to get to the captain, get to the crew, and capture the ship and, slaughter them. Nobody cares. And she winds up as a pivot point. And then at the time, we were trying to think, there's got to be somebody that she, not overtly, but she has kind of a spark with a little bit. And we started off saying Paris. Because, Harry's too dippy, and Chakotay was up. He was her captain as a Maquis and all that.
Right.
And not Neelix. So that left Paris. And at the time, we were like, okay, if there's anybody that might be just a little bit of, early in the show, sidelong glance, it might be Paris. Then there was, I think, Cathexis, where she says, oh, I had a dream about Chakotay or something. And we were like, maybe they're going to go with Chakotay. Okay. So we did it either way, whoever they wanted to do. But basically, at the end of it, as my wife tells the story, B'Elanna in the last scene has to decide whether she's going to kill her Klingon lover or kill Paris and or Chakotay. And who's she going to go with?
Oh,
and she finally, And we had all kinds of things. The Klingons could be blown out of the sky. The Klingons could be, pushed off like Khan's guys. They could be put down on a planet to colonize. We had all kinds of things going on with this. And we did, they bought it. I have the facts where Jerry was outlining this to Michael. And then at the end, she says, I think it's a second season show. I know it's somewhat vague, but I wanted to run it by you. And Michael Piller hand wrote, let's go ahead and develop it. And so Janet faxed that to me and said, look, they bought it. So that was a little celebration day.
Nice.
And then a few weeks later, after the holidays, we had a story meeting. And I think everyone was there but Bran. And he was probably 9 days deep into it or behind on a script or something, madly working on it. And it was after the air. So they bought it in December. The show, the pilot, was on to the public at large at the end of January. So we pitched and sold this a month before the pilot aired, but they had been selling, they'd been doing episodes along. And through the story session, we sat down and we had pitched a bottle show, right? It's like, hey, it's cheap because you're going to have to do Klingon makeup here a little bit and do a Klingon ship. And of course, we wanted to do the unending saga of the show, a D7. Quit getting the Katinga out. Mm-hmm. And they didn't. This is sad to say. The hands-on people always knew what was going on. The art department. but the upstairs, not so much. So it was like, but the Katinga's already done, and we don't have a decent filmable, you know, because the, you know, and this is pre-CGI, so. Anyway, it wound up being, when they actually finally did do it, it was supposed to be a D7, and Jeff Mandel, a friend on the art, did the maps, Star Trek maps, both 80 years ago, in 80 years ago, 20 years ago and lately. He was working on Voyager then, and his whole big backlit on the Klingon bridge, which later got cut anyway, mostly, he did a D7, and then they wound up using a Katinga model, so there you go. But anyway, we sold it, we had a story meeting, and then it went crazy, because Michael was real, if you remember in Basics 1 and 2, how he had the, you know, the primitive aliens when the Kazon took over the Voyager, and mm-hmm. he strands the crew, and they have the alien, aliens there, and they even had like a language with subtitles. Michael was real into, let's really have a lot of production value and really make Voyager this in-depth show, and we'll have, one of the things was, let's show these are really Kirk-era Klingons. Let's have them, like, subjugating. We don't find them on a ship in space, which was the cheap way to do it. You know, we'll pull all the Klingon sets from storage. And it's like, let's put them on a planet. Let's have them have subjugated an alien, a lesser-developed alien. And they're just the Klingons like Kirk would have found. And, you know, because then we're looking at each other like, well, do we make them smooth heads or bumpy heads? And then they kind of give us that, oh, don't go, don't make us think about that. And I said, it was, you know, it would, the fans would love this show if we explained the forehead bumpy head thing here. And, you know, face it, in the games had always just said, well, they bred some human Klingon hybrids in the border areas to deal with humans. So not to give away so much about our physiology, it is a, you know, it was that old chestnut of an idea.
Right.
And then you say, well, how did Korin, Kang, and Koloff come out with bumps in DS9? And blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, those are surgically... I was going to say, those were surgically altered, but your grunts, your red shirts of the Klingon variety were the ones who were... The cannon fodder were bred, crossbred. Anyway, but we said, hey, we can answer the Klingon forehead question here. We can do all kinds of things.
Oh, there you go.
And they were like, no, let's not do that. Let's just do bumpy hits. Okay, fine. But Michael was the one blowing it up and saying, let's put it on a planet. Now we're like outdoors with alien sets and everything. And Ken Biller, who was a rookie on the first year of the show, and he was like, and we can have like the Japanese guy that was in the jungle for 40 years and didn't know the war was over. And at first it was like, that's cool. And then we got home and I was like, what? How was that supposed to, what? Where did that go with this? So anyway, so we were sent home to write. Now, very rarely do they let first-time story sellers write a script, but we got sent home to work on the story document, which is a prose, you know, paragraph document. And so we took all of the notes from Michael and everybody, which is kind of like this gibberish. And it was so funny because I'd always interviewed freelancers. I'd interviewed the from their side of things. I'd interviewed the staff writers and producers from their side. Where, you know, we sent them home as a test and came back. And sometimes it's not always about putting every single thing someone in the story meeting said, cram it in there, because then you wind up with a camel, you know, instead of a horse.
Right.
So we sat down and tried. Now, we already knew that this was not going to go fast because they had just split B'Elanna in two. So it's like, okay, second season. So we kind of took our time. And along the way, it got a name. It became Reflections for a while, and it was called I've forgotten the other name. Oh, crap. Anyway.
I really like Untitled Klingon, though, as a name.
Untitled Klingon, that yeah.
Just stick with name. That.
That's what half of all scripts start off being called. Untitled, you know, Untitled Warp 10 Barrier. Oh, we all know where that went.
So your original pitch was actually similar to where it ended up with, where they just meet a Klingon ship in space. But I guess without the baby concept, without the religious concept.
Again, they were baby characters. The whole show was about B'Elanna being caught in the middle between the two crews, the Klingon captain never giving up his thing about taking over the ship, Janeway being duped into thinking she could be the, you know, mother, whatever, and then they're going to go for it. And then it comes down to B'Elanna in the crux, and she has to decide. You know, it's still an early Maquis-ish. It's not just a Maquis, is she going to go with the crew or not? But now it's a, she hates it because the thing she hated so much is the thing that won her over, and now she hates herself for being won over so easily by the thing she always hated. Kind of a thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that being a really solid season 2 Voyager episode.
So could I. And I guess Michael and Jerry did too there at the beginning. So here's what happened, though. So we wrote a story document. It bogged down. Michael got all into... Mm-hmm. By that time, he was kind of leaving the show and going off and developing other things. And after about a year... Okay, number one, they said, we're not going to do it in the second season because we've just had a Romulan and we've had Ferengis, and they're supposed to be in the Delta Quadrant. We don't... That'd be one more Alpha.
Right, yeah.
This was supposed to be the show that broke away and did New Ground, and that's going to get old. So we'll put it back. Because they bought it. They paid us for the story. So it's... Okay. So the year goes by, and then it's third season, and it's like, okay, and no, Worf is at DS9, and it's a big Klingon arc and story, and if we do this story, we look like we're just piling on the bandwagon. So let's put it back another year. Okay. And so by now it's the fourth season, and things evolved, and Tom and B'Elanna are dating, and it's like, this is never going to get made, you know? It's nice, we got paid, but it'll never see the light of day. It'll be a fun story we'll tell on some bozo thing called a podcast 15 years from now.
With a couple of bozos named Mike and Dan.
With a couple of bozos. Bozo 1 and Bozo Orange
One of them
cat.
Wearing an orange hat.
Yeah. The beardless orange hatted one. Yeah. What a kuvama. Okay.
Greg's so... all kinds of first season serious today.
Yes.
So that's what happened. It went along, show went along. Oh yeah, well, we still... No one cares. We're in the big boneyard of stories sold, but never, you know, they'd buy stories in the last year of a series and not get it crammed in, and everybody, you know, has that. But it was cool. And we kept pitching and pitching on both shows, and two or three ideas that I thought DS9 would buy, but instead they just used them anyway without them knowing. So fast forward, thankfully, to the seventh season. So Michael's gone on. Jerry has retired from Hollywood, period. Brannon is the showrunner. Ginn goes off to do Enterprise with Rick to develop it, and they let Ken run the show the last year as the active hands-on showrunner. Yes, they were still actively involved in making the show. But Ken was the day-to-day showrunner. And as I would do, I would go by after the hiatus break, like in July, and say hi to everybody and kind of say hellos. And when everybody came back first day, and said hi to Ken, congratulations, you're gonna have, you know, you get to close it out for the last year. And he said, Larry, do you happen to have your notes on that show you guys pitched and sold first season? And you know, my inside thing goes but I go, I'm being very cool, calm, because you don't jinx anything. I go, why? I'm trying to be super cool. And it's like the, remember at the end of Raiders when they stuck the Ark of the Covenant away in the warehouse in Washington? Well, that was a cleaned up version of the Paramount Archives. Because there's a box with all the memos and notes and everything business content devoted to any script gets put away. Lolita and Janet and Bob Gillen on DS9 would put everything away at the end of a season. They couldn't retrieve any of the notes on that stuff. So he asked me, so I had my stuff at home, of course, and brought it in. And I'm like, don't tell anybody. It'll jinx it. Don't tell anybody. Now, of course, B'Elanna and him are almost, well, by that time they were married. Well, they were about to be married. We knew that already, or I knew that already. Mm-hmm. It's the last year of the show. It's been moved way on. And I went, well, this will be interesting, but I didn't know. So they did it. And it got developed. Every once in a while, somebody would say, hey, we're working on your story. It's still alive. It's still in. And I'd see the script status reports, and Untitled Klingon was still in there. Only it got the name, and I prophecy. And then the log line was, you know, B'Elanna's pregnant baby, or B'Elanna's, womb is hailed as the prophesied savior of a Klingon cult. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting.
That's a little different.
But I mean, I knew that would happen. And then when I saw there were 19 names on it.
Sure, yeah.
You know. So that's basically it. Now, what's interesting, even about the way they did it, was they shot the whole first scene. Now, when you watch, and we had a view party, and, you know, number one, I found that it was really going to be made. It was really going to, when I knew they were shooting it on the schedule and I saw the first day's call sheet, I finally said, okay, now I can tell people. he won't jinx it.
Right.
So, you know, and then I saw this, they were very kind. They could have easily knocked us, you know, we got paid for our story. They kept us on the story credit, even though it got updated in story form and then the teleplay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now we're splitting the residual six ways instead of two, but we would have at least been splitting it three ways with the script going to somebody else. And
right.
They filmed. We went as the old custom that had kind of gotten away from, but when Michael first started the open script policy, if it was somebody's first script sale, they would let you come in and watch film one of the days, if not more.
Oh, okay.
If you were, you know, like really... you brought in lots of, you know, alcohol or something, maybe you'd watch more than one day. Or really sleazy or something. No, I'm kidding. And, you know, Janet worked there. This is after she'd left the show as an employee. But, you know, and I was there on the lot doing stuff and would come over as a reporter or interviewer or something or prop photographer or something. But this is very cool to be there as the writers, or at least the story writers, and you should make that very clear that we had the story. So we watched the day they were filming some of the fight, some of the combat scenes, and you know, and Janet's like going, "This is our story," and I'm like, "It's okay." I mean, but she was smart enough to know it had changed a lot.
Yeah.
And of course, we had the script, and it was a fun. You know, I had the call. Well, I had all the call, but I had that call sheet signed, and I had the script signed by everybody there that day, and some of the guest stars. But what was cool was we went over to the bridge and had our picture. Some of the pictures you may have seen us in our picture at conventions for a long time we used was us in the Klingon captain's chair and back by the graphics. And there's a whole side story that I'm not going to bore your podcast people with, but it's very cool, and I tell it at conventions, and I don't want to give everything away. But it involves, I will just say this, since it's in a scene, well, let me say this first. They had this whole Klingon bridge scene. What you see on screen, I mean, talk about your deleted scenes. The show opens, they're on the bridge, and Tom Paris says, "Oh, Captain, there's a Klingon ship signature we're detecting. Oh, 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 oh." And they look up and ding, there it is on the... And, oh, it's a Klingon ship! Dum, dum, dum! You know, way out here in the Delta Quadrant.
Larry sounds exactly like Robbie Duncan McNeil, doesn't he?
Uh-huh. You like that?
Yeah.
I had my refresher course. The one day a year when I'd see him on Chuck, I got my refresher course. Okay. So,
yeah.
And now that was actually when Garrett was at the helm filling in. And no, I'm kidding. The show actually opens, and of course it's their script, with you're on a Klingon bridge. You see a dead guy on a like a bower there, and you realize you're on a Klingon bridge, and a Klingon has died, and they're doing the Klingon death wail and the whole thing. And you realize the first officer just became captain, and the second officer is now first officer. And right as they've just done their Klingon, you know, yell to Stovokor, which we hadn't seen in years on the show, they kind of ignored that of all the dead Klingons falling right and left. Then the Klingon helmsman in Klingonese says, "Captain, Captain, this is amazing. We're going to get a Federation signature. Look, it's a starship." But of course, they're going, "Wow, that's like no starship we've ever seen before. Are you sure it's Federation?" "Yes, yes." So then it immediately cuts to, you know, then it's, or something. "Captain, look, it's a Federation signature. It's a starship." And they cut to, "Captain, Captain, look, it's a Klingon starship. We're picking up a Klingon signature. Are you sure?" Dump, 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 teaser. Well, the show ran long, and they totally cut the first scene. After they'd spent five or six Klingons, makeup, the set, putting a bridge together, the graphics, the optical on the view screen, the whole thing.
Wow.
The other problem with that is, and then I'll shut up. They, I don't know, I've gone on here. They, and I've ruined my blockbuster, The Making of Prophecy book now. They, if you watch the episode now, and I was looking at like Cher's notes, and I'm sorry, miss you, Sherilyn. I'm sorry. I screwed up your appearance tonight. Your Voyager editor. The thing that bugged me about the show, just watching it, is A. This is the wimpiest Klingon captain you've ever seen as the show evolves the way it is now. And B, he's got the bitchiest first officer you've ever seen. It's worse than, you know, Riker and Elizabeth Dennehy. I've forgotten her. Shelby. Right, yeah. It's worse than Riker and Shelby.
Shelby, yes.
But it's really the same thing. You've got she wasn't the third officer, but you've got the captain just gone. You've got an untried first becoming captain. Now, if you had that first scene, you would have got that he was just captain. But if you watch that show,
that makes sense.
I don't know if that bugged you guys, but it's like, why is he such a wuss? And why is this guy? Why is he like slapping this guy down? And then the other thing is, halfway through the show, it's like the disease, and they just the disease just falls in out of nowhere.
Yeah, the disease did kind of just come out of nowhere, right?
Well, originally, all that was in the first scene, but they lost it. So they lost more than a chunk of budget. They lost those story points. So, anyway,
well,
fire away.
I always took the captain's behavior. I just kind of chalked it up to the fact that they were a generational ship, and that over the generations, because was it three generations? I think he says they were out there, that they just kind of became a little bit less Klingon-like. And he was kind of, although some of the Klingons on the ship were very, very Klingon-like, but yeah, this guy was very
DNA dilution.
I thought he just had like the Klingon, the melancholy disease or something was going on with him.
But I mean, back to the big sky days. What am I trying to say? Sky's the limit days, whatever.
Yeah, that was our football discussion in the other side of the room. The Big Sky Conference.
The other side of the midnight room. No, wait, that's something else. That's for anyone that saw Star Wars on opening weekend back in 1977 will understand that. Maybe, if you still have your gray matter and you remember the 80s. Yes. The other thing that we thought about besides, we can use this to explain Klingon foreheads, was wouldn't this be cool, and it is the last season, but it would be fun. Of course, we pitched it for the first season and to have it through the whole show. But we said, what if this generational ship, I mean, we didn't put them in cryopods or anything. It wasn't a sleeper ship. They were up and running around and, you know, out of their seats during the flight.
Yeah.
And we thought, wouldn't it be fun if they were populating so well, going forth and multiplying, being fruitful, that as they came out from the Alpha Quadrant, they would find, you know, Class M, civilized, lesser developed planets, and colonize them. And leave a chunk of, you know, have enough replicator manufacturing stuff, they would leave it behind. Now, it was just a bird of prey, although we all know that there's, like, the biggie bird of prey and the little bird of prey, and they're exactly the same scale, right? The Katinga and the Kavort. But we basically said, what if there was, like, this patchwork, not shuttlecraft, hopscotch. There's a patchwork of Klingon colonies that they took over.
That's what they call the Klingon Trail.
Yeah. Very good. Highway 47, the Klingon Trail.
<That's right>. Yeah.
And that as Voyager went back, you know, at the beginning we said, wouldn't it be funny if, like, once a season they pass by some Klingon colony where they've either attacked by Klingons or they help, you know, the poor downtrodden aliens get up from under their Klingon yoke, or they have a prime directive or whatever.
Yeah, but, or maybe...
You know, we said, you could do that.
Yeah, it would be great if the Klingons could have shown up in Voyager. I mean, but how much resistance would there have been against that among the powers at B.I.? I feel like they were trying to get away from by putting the show in the Delta Quadrant, it's like they're saying, I don't want the Romulans or the Klingons or any of these things.
Well,
in the show.
Ultimately they didn't go there, but the whole point was it was one of those things like you go, ooh, here's Guinan, she's a mysterious person, we don't know anything about her background, and then it's up to you to do something with it as fast as you want to do. And it would have been the thing of,
right,
Captain, what we were thinking about doing was have the whole thing happen, they either blow them up or put them on a planet or what they do with them, and then at the end, you know, someone's going through the database, Tuvok or Harry or somebody, and comes in at the very end of the show and goes, we were going back through their logs translating, and they've left, 4.7 colonies between here and the Alpha Quadrant behind. And, you know, who knows of those colonies if we come across them, you know, but we know now they're out there. One of those kind of things. And then if you either find them or you don't. It's kind of like there's another caretaker out there somewhere, and they're so desperate for stories, they do it in the second season.
Right.
And it's a wimpy story.
Right. Well,
you know.
Right. Well, yeah, the end of Space Seed, that they could have gone back to that later in the show.
Which episode?
Who knows what will happen if we come back. Space Seed.
Which one was that?
They sort of say at the very end.
They could have gone back to SETI Alpha 5 and visited Khan.
Did they bring him back?
Alpha 5.
During the show.
During the show. At some
during
point.
During the third season.
That's they brought him back on another episode. That's sort of forgotten. That's great.
They could have done that.
Well, no, but exactly like that, Greg. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. That was just too much for me. I was being very mean there. Sorry.
I would say that I have a feeling that even though there are 4.7 colonies, so it's not that many in the entire Delta Quadrant, I guarantee you that they would have come across all four and the 0.7, which is, I guess, the most recent one that's still in progress. Mm-hmm. Would have come across them.
It is Star Trek.
So, Larry, let me just say here, I think this idea that you have that the Klingons would, you know, be reproducing so well that they would leave behind all these colonies, I think that ties into the true A story that you had, as Greg noticed, which was, don't you tell Greg what the A story is?
I mean, Larry, I think this last half hour you've been spinning this tale to us about the original pitch has been fascinating, really fascinating. But I looked through the archives, Larry. I looked through the documents. The original pitch is Harry getting hit on by a Klingon for 43 minutes. And I don't know how you sold that to Jerry.
Okay,
I don't.
Greg, I'm going to put you back in the closet, I guess. you know, I've had this for 10 plus years. I've had, more than 10 years, isn't it? God, I wish I hadn't gone there. Okay, so for like half a century, I've had this well-crafted story, and you had to go do your damn little investigative journalism and just blow you little citizen bloggers just because you have a computer. You make you think like you're a trained journalist, and blow my story out of the water. I'm just so shocked, ashamed, and pissed. I can't. You're absolutely right. It was all about Harry. Here you go. Klingon need what am I trying to say? This Starfleet needs Klingon women. I mean, I don't know what Ops needs Klingonesses.
Because this was originally going to be a first season story, and at that time Neelix had Kes on there, so you didn't think about it. But then later on, you were able to turn Neelix into this like wild lover, you know, crazy ladies.
Klingon
man.
Love machine god.
Klingon love machine god. Yeah.
Neelix, which, you know, conjures up its own images right there.
I mean, do you have the original Voyager, you know, story Bible where we could read where it talked about how Neelix is a, you know, raging sex maniac? Because I'm sure they were just waiting for the chance to reveal that on the show.
Knowing that whole thing about being the bartender, jack of all trades, scout guy, that no one was going to fall for that.
Yes, exactly.
No one was going to fall for that. Oh, now you made me like,
And while we're talking about Neelix, and of course, Larry, you mentioned earlier that Charlene was going to join us, but she wasn't able to at the end.
I screwed it all up for her. I'm so sorry.
She does have a thing in her notes, though, that she left for us here. She wants to know if Neelix ever signed the alien mating form that the doctor gave him.
Oh. Well, you know, he wasn't Starfleet, so he kind of evaded that somehow.
Oh, there you go.
There's no, come on. See, I'm sorry, but the show that was the most, and I mean, I admired all these people, and I worked very closely with them. I wasn't on the payroll, but I had to make sure I wasn't run off the lot in certain ways with all the things I was doing. But you can say this Voyager. I think Voyager is the show. Maybe if Voyager was the show that had the most franchise, as Rick tried to say, franchise fatigue with it. I think part of that, and people love to rag on the canonistas and, oh, the anal fans, blah, blah, blah. But I think Voyager was the one that had the most trouble with continuity at times, little things, or maybe even big things. And you're laughing about Neelix and the alien pledge, but the alien sex pledge, but that's right. I will have alien sex every day. No, wait, I won't have alien sex every day.
That's Harry's pledge. I will never, ever.
Yeah. damn it, I never will have alien sex. But Voyager is the series of all of them, even Enterprise, is the one that suffered the most from having the most showrunners. I mean, a lot of people don't think about that, but it started with Jerry and Michael Coe, and then Brannon was like brought in real fast, and I swear to God, there was a point in the second season, and this is where it's handy having someone right there, where the three of them went around on the infamous page changes I want to say it's Phage, where Neelix's lung is stolen by the Vidians.
That's Phage, yeah.
Yeah, in the debut of that. But anyway, they're on a planet. It's not important. They're barely on the planet. It's just there for exposition. And I want to say it's the one where he's, you know, then after that, they're off and running, chasing them. The initial planet doesn't matter. But they're on a body with gravity that they're walking around. They can use the cave set, okay? And the script pages went around and around over whether they were going to call it a planet, a planetoid, or a moon. Or maybe it was a planetoid, a moon, and an asteroid. And one of the three wanted one, and they would mark it out, and it would rotate around. And it went around and around for three or four. I mean, with other things. But embedded in the other major changes with this little thing, they wouldn't do that petty over one thing. But they would all, moon, planetoid, asteroid, moon, planetoid, asteroid. Why did I go there? Oh, because that was the case where they had, the three of them were all kind of even. And then Michael left, and it was Jerry and Brannon. And then Jerry retired, and Brannon ran the show for 2 years, and then Ken did. So there's, in Next Generation, I don't know if people realize this or not, but the first 2 years when there was kind of a chaotic writing staff, and then Maury Hurley kind of emerged to be the head writer, and then he was the head writer of the second season and then left the show, and then Michael was there from then on. And then Jerry kind of, in the end, kind of came up under him. If there's any Next Generation continuity errors, it's little things that were forgotten from the first two seasons by the guys from later on. Not a lot of things.
Right.
They totally forgot about Mr. Zelo being before Mr. Holm as Loxana's, which I pointed out to Renee, and his eyes got real big at the end of the series. But if you remember, in Haven, Deanna comes on and says, "What happened to Mr. Zelo? Oh, he had pornographic thoughts of me," and she got rid of him. How was that for a Majel Barrett Loxana impersonation, Greg?
Okay. That was fantastic. I have to hire you to join the show as not Majel Barrett.
Pornographic thoughts.
Every time we need a quote from her.
But then at the end in Dark Page, she says, "Well, I got a hold of Mr. Holm, and he sent me all this stuff on Kestra, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "Well, so we're kind of getting around the fact that Marina that Mr. Holm wasn't there before she met him the first season." But those are the kinds of things that's a little tiny thing. That's a tiny thing. But Voyager suffered the most from that. And laugh about your Klingon sex pledge, but that's the kind of... And that was just a year later. But, you know. I was just reading the Neelix description here, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Neelix is an alien male unlike any we've ever seen, in that he has an irreplaceable, unstoppable urge to mate with any Klingon ass he's ever seen.
That's right there in the writer's guide.
Even right before there. They came up with the name...
Neelix, pronounced Nylix. Yeah.
This is not like from the first year. This is a later one that was repackaged. This is the last season revision, which you can see there, guys.
Nice.
Of course, you on the mere podcast audience aren't seeing this as we record it. The revision of 32399. I would never make up a thing like that about Neelix and the writers.
No.
I'd never do that. Maybe.
All right. Well, so one thing I'm curious about.
I just wrecked this whole episode. There's some boring notes we can talk about, like, Ren T. Brown was a shuttle pilot in Next Generation and blah, blah, blah. He was a Klingon here. I mean, we could do normal stuff like that. But, you know.
Well, no, because we went on into the seventh season, and by this time, Paris and B'Elanna are together. B'Elanna's pregnant. Then they're able to introduce this whole idea that B'Elanna's baby is the Messiah to the Klingon people, at least as this kind of cult of Klingons who live in the Delta Quadrant see it. And so, I mean, how did that particular element come about? And did you get to have just kind of happen off there? And this is where your wife is saying, "This is our story?" Or what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we knew that. Now, I was kidding about the forehead thing, but I mean, I interviewed everybody. But Mike Sussman told me that he was of like mind, Mike, who finally helped it happen on Enterprise. But Mike, who was Sussman, who was also a fan as well as a professional, who would get shot down when he was a junior writer by the, don't go there, it's too complicated, yada, yada. But he was wanting to do something with the foreheads, take the opportunity that these were 100 century old fresh Klingons, or, you know, stale maybe, after being alone, but that they were, you know, right from that cloth, they were undiluted, I guess. It just evolved. I mean, it, out of the, they were trying to think of what would, the fact that, you know, she was pregnant, and they'd mm-hmm. they'd already had the story.
Right. I mean,
I've gone blank, where she agonizes over whether to change its DNA and make it not Klingon when she finds out it's more Klingon.
Mm-hmm. Right, they did that one.
So,
and now that she's with Tom, she can't sort of be caught between
two
lovers. Oh,
yeah, it was way beyond. Yeah,
because that would just, like, so there's no way they could possibly do that. So I guess it makes sense.
That's why I say it was a baby character when we pitched. It was an infant character. Right. Now it's, you know, she's married and pregnant. Yeah. No, you can't use any of that.
Right.
So technically,
so I guess they look at the B'Elanna character and they see, well, what can we do with her to make her involved in this? And I guess it makes sense to use the baby for something. I feel like it's
because we always love messianic Klingons.
They never did this with,
don't we?
Yeah. Right.
If you've ever been to a convention and watch a bunch of them trying to hold on to their party room, you can know just how messianic they.
I just feel like it's if we'd gone back to, like, Next Gen and we'd happened upon Klingons who believed that, you know, Alexander was Kalus reborn. Like, that's, like, I guess you could have done that, but...
See, you don't know how...
I don't know.
You don't know how true that... You know the poor kid that played Alexander, not the first little kid, but the Brian Bonsall that had been on... that had been on Family Ties. He's had a troubled life, I guess you could say. He's had a little bit of a Lindsay Lohan type, former Lindsay Lohan. She's all cleaned up now. Mm-hmm. But he was one that had a kind of a child actor troubled life later. And I guess it showed, because back when they were filming the shows, they were like, he was great and he wore the makeup well and all that, but he was apparently not the best child actor they'd ever had on the set. So, I mean, as far as not his acting, but everything else.
Yeah.
And they were like, do we really want to... The whole idea of having Alexander become an adult was so they could finally, like, not reuse the actor.
Right.
But it was so late in the series, they were like, no, we can't. Somebody, Michael said, we can't. Or Jerry said, we're not going to steal that child's childhood. You know, it's like, well, it's a fictional character. It's science fiction. We can do it.
Right.
But she didn't want to steal Alexander's childhood and growing up years from him, so...
Very thoughtful.
So you're saying this, the eventual story choice didn't set well with you? Is that what you're saying, young Gregster?
Yeah, well,
the clean face.
If we're getting to, actually, if we're getting, you know, 45 minutes into the episode, actually talking about the episode as shot. No, it does. It strikes me as a little odd. And it's actually, there's Battlestar Galactica where the president's cancer is cured by the magic half Cylon baby, and that doesn't sit well with me either.
So say we all.
Well, that the Battlestar Galactica one was really weird. I mean, why would a half Cylon baby be able to cure Rosalind's cancer? But
why would a half Klingon baby be able to cure a genetic disease?
For me, I don't know. The concept of the baby here for me worked fine because they did have to find a way to get her involved, and she was pregnant, and so. And the idea that you would have these Klingons who wander off into the Delta Quadrant and become kind of like a cult, you know. I mean, I said in the other side of the room, they're kind of like the group of people who thought that they're...
The other side of the room. Yes.
That's right. That thought that there was a, you know, spaceship in the tail of Halley's Comet or whichever comet came by in the 90s. You know, these Klingons are very cultish like that, and the idea that they would believe that the baby was some kind of messiah is fine, and the fact that when you have mixed genes even on Earth between different races, often those genes can be stronger because weaknesses in the genes that affect one race, mm-hmm. you know, you're more robust. The genes can be more robust when you have the idea that this Klingon DNA in the in B'Elanna's baby might have some effect on curing some disease in Klingons. I mean, it's not totally unbelievable for me when I'm watching it in a science fiction story. So I think it worked okay. I was just curious how that came about. Given the original concept, and then as the characters evolve, and now we're almost at the end of the series, and having to kind of connect those two ideas and find a way to make that all work in the end. It was an interesting twist they put on it, for me anyway.
Well, I've got to save some things for the book, so. No, I mean, but what you said is like, how many different avenues are there to go down, and what's dramatic, right. And what can you shoot on a cave set, and the infamous caves. Yeah, and again, that wasn't our decision. We were just happy to still, you know, be in on
right.
it. But, you know, to this day, Janet will say, well, I think... Now, and I thought the Neelix Klingon, they actually pulled that off, and it was actually comical, and for once it was a yeah. plus for, you know... Yeah. I'm not yeah. necessarily a Neelix basher. I know there are some in this universe who are, and but I don't know how anybody could like not enjoy that. It was just kind of wacky. I was just disappointed.
It was pretty fun.
I was indeed, though, you know, sad to see it get cut down from the 43-minute A story down to what it was. But when it took the place of the Harry A story. But
right,
yeah. There's only so much you can do with, like you said, when she's there and engage
yeah.
and have it be something that's shootable and relatable and
right.
Yeah.
Well, what about the we got the other element where you have Paris taking on the Klingon in, you know, blunted Batleth battle, which is sort of reminiscent of Amok Time
mm-hmm.
and other various things.
House of Quark.
So we're mm-hmm. House of Quark. Yes. So here we are doing it on Voyager. Was anything similar to that in your original pitch
when
you had Paris?
No.
Oh, okay. So that was all.
In fact, I mean, we thrown here's in the thing, and I know we can take up two more minutes. Something was in the actual episode. When after about a year of trying to do a story on Michael's notes, and he had kind of drifted away from this series, Jerry came up to us and said, "Why don't you all do a story based on your original pitch again, you know, and keep this in this."
Hmm.
Oh, and there's no camera. Guess what we're talking about? We're talking about Prophecy.
Oh,
our yeah. pitch.
Our what?
Our pitch.
Yeah, well,
and the story.
We had a better idea than what was done.
See, that's what I said. To this day, Janet will say, ours was better anyway.
Ours is better.
It was hard cutting, and it made B'Elanna the pivot point.
Not just that, but it
right.
what?
Would have made the Maquis possibly take over the ship.
Yeah, she was saying it would have put the Maquis in an upper hand on the ship.
Mm-hmm. Which might have been dramatic, right?
It might have actually used uh-huh. the Maquis in an interesting way.
Oh, the word conflict.
What?
Like conflict?
Yeah, like confident. Yeah. Well, her thing used to always be she wanted to see the show every week and not know who was sitting in the captain's chair the first year or two at least. Like, was it a Maquis or was it a Federation person?
And then one day Harry ends up there and everyone's really surprised.
And even the Federation people are going, no.
All right, well, that brings up my next bullet point, which is, where is Chakotay? Like all episode.
Okay, Greg has a theory about this. Greg has a theory of what Chakotay is doing for this whole episode, and actually,
he had griped at Janeway so much that he never got to do anything that she finally started making it a self fulfilling. She's gonna. I'm gonna put.
No,
I'm
no.
Gonna
my theory.
Harry in command of a shuttlecraft and let you be his crew. No, I'm kidding.
There you go. No, he was down, you know, in the cargo bay doing a census of all the Klingons, and that took him. All episode, he was just, you know, tracking bloodlines and all of that, tracking names. Because he does, am I wrong here, he disappears for the entire episode. And has nothing to do.
Actually, he had a big scene where he counseled Scotty, and that was cut for time. Oh, wait, that's Troy and Relics with Scotty. That's right.
right.
He had a big scene where he was counseling Klingons, and he... No, and it was cut. And,
Greg, explain to Larry why Chakotay was taking a census of the Klingons.
Well, yes. So this was, yeah.
You so thought Chakotay Neelix got all the action. That's on... what you thought. No.
Wait, did exactly. you read Greg's
well,
book?
Well, Chakotay had been reading up. Chakotay had been reading up on Kirk and Riker and all these things, and he wanted to try to follow. So along with his census, you know, he was asking, you know, okay, so which house are you from? Okay, and how old are you? Okay, now will you have sex with me? No.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And just move on to the next one. And they all said no, unfortunately.
But it took him the whole 40 minutes to find that out.
Exactly. To get through each and every one of them and to find out that none of them.
Yeah, there were 240 Klingons.
And the Klingons, and all the Klingon women said, I'm sorry, but your tattoo just turns me off.
That tattoo is so repulsing.
You really must do something about that, human. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't spit enough.
But they were really into Neelix, though. And
well, you know.
But yeah, Neelix.
Well, sir, there's no accounting for taste.
And actually, one more thing here from Charlene's notes. Now, she said PDH just doesn't want to get any, right? Because if you track through the series, how many opportunities has Harry had? Like, there's the episode Prime Factors where that girl on that planet takes him off to the far-off world. And she's, like, really clearly into Harry, and he's just completely oblivious. And now he's got actually has a Klingon chasing him around the ship, and he tries everything he can do to get out of it.
Well, and who's the one? Now the running joke, the manufactured running joke was that Tom would always pull on him was he falls for the hologram, he falls for the for the alien he can't have, he falls for the so go down the line.
So basically he's Voyager's Geordi.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
There are those who called Voyager TNG light, so maybe that's one of the reasons why. But then you had the Doctor in Seven.
So I guess the real question is that in your original story pitch, did Harry get laid? that's the real question that
I
we need to know.
You know, I'm trying to think. I think for about 47 seconds, it was the E story.
The E story, yes. It's always my favorite part of every episode.
You had to have an E ticket for the E story, but yeah. That's a Disneyland joke. Okay.
Yes. Well, so the episode as a whole, like, I don't know. I had not gone back and watched Prophecy in a while. Chris, you hadn't gone back and watched Prophecy in a while.
I hadn't seen it in a while. Yeah, I watched it last night again, yeah.
So was it any good?
Actually, it is good. I'm not a big fan of Klingon stories, to be honest, but I actually did enjoy Prophecy. I thought it was really cool to see the cargo bay with 240 Klingons in it. And on Voyager itself. And I thought it was a legitimate way for the Klingons to end up on the ship while they were still in the Delta Quadrant, because it is believable that you would have this kind of rogue ship that goes off like that, and they would come to believe these things.
One other thing we threw in the mix of, if you just do this story, you can open up all kinds of doors if you like, guys, was the fact that we had said that this ship in the Delta Quadrant didn't have to be before this whole thing with the cult and all that, but back when it was we came back and said, what if this was you tied this into, if you really wanted to be fan anal, tie this into the time when somewhere between the failed Romulan Alliance and Khitomer, and the Klingons are feeling kind of paranoid, and one of the things they do about the paranoia is that's what the DNA manipulation crossbreeding project was about. That was part of it. And one of it was, forget being hemmed in by the Federation and the Romulans. We'll just, like, do a big leapfrog and send ships out in 10 different directions. And this was one of the ships that was sent out to, to leapfrog out. And if they can, to find resource planets. And, if there's wimpy little weak natives that are just destined to be overtaken by us, then so be it. But you could even have that as the tapestry of the background, and even have them find out that it wasn't just this ship coming our direction. There were ships going other directions too, from 100 years ago, and you could have all kinds of fun with that. But that was a paranoid defense reaction to what was going on pre-Alliance, which feeds even more into the fact that they can't conceive of the fact that there was ever a detente in a Khitomer Accord.
Well, I mean, there you go. Where Voyager at its best is sort of doing TOS. Where you are doing Strange New Worlds and all of that. And if you brought in TOS Klingons, that would be actually quite interesting. I probably would have preferred running into crazy warlike Klingons rather than the Borg so much over seasons, you know, 6 and 7.
Well, mm-hmm. I thought it was cool that they, you know, the Borg were said to be from that quadrant in the mm-hmm. very beginning. But to make
eventually.
To make them a running, yeah.
But yeah, but bring the Klingons in too. I mean, because the Kazon were never a legitimate threat. I don't know. I'd like to see that in the story Bible. Who came up with the Kazon?
Oh boy. Well, they were trying to make an allusion to tribes and gangs and
yeah,
have this
street
low
gangs.
Tech,
yeah,
you know, right. inherited technology and try to do a totally different, bizarre take on it, and it just never. And then they tried to recharge, yeah. and I have the memo that Ken Biller wrote when they were trying to recharge the whole Kazon idea, and he gave a whole backstory to them, and they pulled mm-hmm. a lot from it for the episodes, but. Yeah, it just they just came off looking like cheap Klingons.
With, yeah, but actually,
like sponges in their hair, right. In their hair, and but the whole, you know, when you start off with your pilot where you're on a planet that doesn't have water, and water's yeah. a commodity, and it's like, well, go in the atmosphere and wait for a cloud to go by, and I mean, it's like what?
That's right. If they have the technology to have spaceships, they probably have the technology to gather water.
If it's a class M planet that they're living on, where's the...
yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But as I was watching this last night, Larry, there's the scene where Kolar comes into Janeway's ready room and he's standing there and the camera's just on him for a bit. And I was thinking about you and I wanted to take his image and then one of the Majas of the Kazon, put them side by side and label them Junkyard Klingon, real Klingon. That's what I was real thinking Klingon. The whole time. Finally, we have real Klingons on Voyager.
That would have been a good line for someone put on their, the bridge. Oh, thank God!
Actual Klingons.
No change. More of that junkyard crap. And put their disruptor, their guns up. You know, and have real Klingon gun, cheapy yeah. brass tubing with leather strap on it gun. Yeah. Who's going to strike more fear in the hearts?
Now I'm picturing a Kazon mm-hmm. on an ad that says, got water? It's like a wet mustache.
They immediately went, well, that was stupid. Let's retool these guys. So then, yeah, right. yeah. Then it went into the hyperness where you had right. like all, you know, 27 different sects identified, and they all had their different, you know, patterns on their kilts mm-hmm. or whatever it was they were wearing.
They were trying really, really hard. I could tell somewhere in second or third season that they're trying really, really hard to make the Kazon a thing. Yeah.
They were gone by the third.
Was it just second
Basics
season?
Was the end of it.
Okay. Yeah,
when they left them behind on that planet, okay. It was like, okay, that's it. That's done. And
we watched some episode, I guess it was second season, where they cut to one scene of a like spy on Voyager communicating with the Kazon.
No, sadly, it was more than one episode. That
doing?
Was their idea of trying to have a running serial thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it is. It's like, yeah, there's one scene in this episode Jonas. That's going
that's
into
threshold,
this continuity.
Actually, isn't it?
And
where? He tells them, oh, they're developing this Warp 10 engine. And the Kazon's like, ooh, that's very interesting. And then they go on the rest of the episode, and there's like no indication up to that point, and then there's nothing after either. It's just like...
Well, you people obviously don't know about this concept called heavily serialized episodes. No, I'm kidding. It's like one little story thread. And the minute like they were very awkwardly trying to... DS9 was evolving it, and they were having a horrible time getting out of
someone's like,
famous
oh, God, you know, we haven't mentioned that Kazon spy thing. Do we have any footage from some other episode? Sure. Why don't we just splice that right in the middle of the scene? Good idea. That's how it came off.
Came off as the one-off thing. Well, you know, it's kind of like the scene they did of Kes and Neelix breaking up in her show, and it got lost, so they or not her show, her comeback show, but the show where the episode, the scene where they actually kind of quasi break up, and it got cut for time. And
oh, I thought you meant right. her show on Neelix's entertainment network that he had on the ship, where he had like cooking with Neelix and things like that. And it was like Ellen,
sleeping
it was like
with
a
Kes,
talk show
that was
with
the
Kes.
Other show yeah. he had. Yeah,
sleeping. She would dance everywhere. She would try to get other crew members to dance with her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
she put on the green makeup and no.
oh gosh!
So right. yeah, that was prophecy. What's ironic is the whole thing about having the Klingon ship be a D7, and that Jeff had done D7 graphics, and then when the scene got cut, it didn't matter anymore. It was kind of like oh well, we tried again.
Well, it seems like using a particular Klingon ship is worth debating more so than whether it was a planet, planetoid, or moon. Right?
That's, yeah. That kind of details a little bit. Yeah. I mean, these are the important questions that fans want answered. But talk about the way it... Don't faint here, Greg. The way it was actually aired and written. I hate the fact that I don't hate, but the fact that they just blew their ship out of the sky and stranded them on the ship was kind of, yeah. I was like, oh, did you really have to, really? It was like, couldn't you have towed that along to your own little museum and couldn't you have left it somewhere and come back
to get it? It's very dramatic.
Huh?
It is very dramatic, and it's part of what pushes the story forward. And
cutting the tether, cutting the umbilical cord with it.
Right. Why would they blow up
the
ship?
Well, Kolar actually says that, it was the only way we could get on Voyager. It's kind of like, it reminds me of, it's a cult act. I mean,
it's a cult thing.
Zealot religious sects who will take these extreme measures. You know, we have to blow this up to get a clean slate or move forward or whatever. So I don't know, it worked for me fine for the story, but it would have been more interesting to watch them if for the rest of the series they had to tow this Klingon ship around behind them. That would have been really cool. That's like my idea. Remember also I wanted in Tattoo, when the Hawk attacked Neelix, I wish that Neelix had worn an eye patch for the rest of the series. Like curl tie. Yeah.
So say we all.
Right. But could you really have taken Neelix for five more years going, "Arg, Captain, and what be your choice of menu today?" We have some lovely Arg Leola root stew today. Yeah.
I think it would have given some nice flavor to the show.
And then Tuvok would have said, "Mr. Neelix, just because you have lost the use of your actual given birth eye, there's no reason to assume the effecture of a fictional stereotypical..." Forget it.
I do... on that note, we do have the elements of the whole Neelix-Tuvok interaction there. Mm-hmm. And it is nice that they at this point in the series, they actually had these characters that had interpersonal relationships that they could, when they needed a B story, they could put it in.
I'm being crueler than I normally would be just because I saw Voyager so up close. I saw from the end of beginning of Voyager onward on all three shows that were remaining. I saw them up very close. And the easy rap on Voyager is the characters weren't as... There were some iconic characters, but if you got past the Doctor and Seven and the Captain, maybe they weren't as iconic as they could have been. But you're right, and Tim did a great job with Tuvok. And I do defend Ethan, Johnny Phillips. He, they gave him Neelix, I know he was, in his heart trying to make it a dramatic character, and they did things with it. And I think that may have gotten earlier. And Homestead, when he's left behind, I think he pulls that off really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a
fantastic episode.
I think Neelix really got better as the series went on, once Kes was gone and he wasn't just the jealous boyfriend who was...
But I also think that... and maybe when he got out of being the easy... I'm the guide! And they actually had him say, "Well, I'm paranoid now because we're beyond my space and I'm of no use to her and she's going to get rid of me now." But I really think... I never thought of this. I mean, I probably had, but not connected the dots to this degree. Neelix has a little bit of the "shut up, Wesley" syndrome.
Yeah.
Not being the smart-ass kids that saves the ship so much, but the, really? Really? Do we really? Really? Do we need this character, really?
That was Threshold, where they...
really? Milana, do we really talk Harry about Threshold
and Tom
again?
Are having
really?
A problem.
We always talk about Threshold.
I know, I'm totally kidding. Yeah.
But then Neelix gives them the answer. It's like, and that's Neelix's role in the entire script, is just to give them the answer to this highly technical engineering problem.
Oh, one of those June Cleaver kind of moments with a coffee pot in late hours in the mess hall. We kind of wander through and accidentally give them the secret they were all looking for. Have some pancakes. Do whatever. Yeah. Have some more Leola root.
It's like,
souffle.
What if the problem is that it's not that the P peanut butter is coming off the bread, maybe the bread is coming off the peanut butter. What's the deal with that? You're a genius, Mr. It's... Neelix.
I am? Okay. Well, breakfast at 0600. Okay, guys. Yeah.
But I do like the dynamic with Tuvok. And actually, at the end of this episode, Tuvok's face when he comes in his quarters and just standing there, is it really speaks a lot to the ongoing relationship that he has with Neelix. So it was good. And plus, I like Neelix's. He has some pretty cool PJs there, too.
To be the token... Oh, look, we're finally going to do this generational Klingon ship. Oh, look, we're going to have real Klingons. It's not even a dream like Barge of the Dead was. And to have that, and you're thinking, okay, well, that's dramatic. Oh, it's a pregnant baby is, or the, you know, the baby, unborn baby fetus is the prophesied savior of these Klingon cult. That can be heavy stuff, not exactly ha-ha material, but so much of the rest of the show was comedic, and it worked really well, I mean, surprisingly well, and one of the best... actually funny bits for Neelix, you know, and Neelix and Tuvok also. It's kind of shocking, and wow, Voyager could have, it's like the little crumbs of comedy they did have were Tuvok and Neelix, and makes you remember, and the Doctor bits when the Doctor's around, but Well,
I think we've talked about before, Voyager often feels, and this is what you hear from behind the scenes too, that it feels very, very stuffy, very rigid show. Like they really had the clamps down on the cast, and they had the clamps down on the... I guess it's like it was kind of that, you know, golden age of the franchise, and I think they were really, really concerned about the... how it's presented, and of course it was on the network as well, unlike DS9, I think.
You mean like anything that's halfway risque or halfway...
I don't really mean risque. I just mean it was very...
Yeah, like, well, Garrett Wong is... he's complained at conventions that they were told, you know, not to show any emotion. That just read the lines with no emotion, and that... I mean, I don't know how much of that is just Garrett Wong talking at a convention to get attention, but... If that's the feeling had on the show, that's not really helping the organicness.
If you look at the cast and where they were in their careers and their age and maturity and and billing, and, you know, Kate could do what she... I mean, she was the lead, and she had the most, you know, input. I think fairly or unfairly, somebody like Bob Picardo could I don't want to say get away with, but he could pack more sideways stuff into a plane... bit of dialogue than most people can. He's just really good at that,
right?
And and Garrett and Robbie and Robert and you know, Cass, even, although that was that long anyway, which is why you know, Jerry took all the heat when they brought 7 and 9 in, and Jerry's there, and it's like, oh, well, they're just hiring some TNA, but then she did, they wrote the character well. Incredibly, it was like vintage Star Trek outsider on a path character, and then she carried it off.
That's what I feel like when she's really good. Like the scenes with between Janeway and Seven,
and the Janeway Seven thing worked.
Those seasons are really, really good.
So it's
And people say, well, the show got really bad there at the end. I think the show got really good. I think it really came into its own, and I think Prophecy is even part of that. I mean, it is a pretty good quality episode. It's got great bits.
See, it's
it.
Really hard for me, and all seriousness aside, no, I'm kidding. Seriously, it's hard for me to, I don't want to say it's hard for me to objectively watch it. I don't mean that. I mean, I can watch it without cringing or crying or something. Like, what could have been? No, it's not that. It was very lucky that they brought me, honestly, personally, on a personal human level, it was very cool that they, A, used the concept, and B, kept us attached to it till we got, you know, a little bit of money out of it as the residuals after it aired. But it's hard for me to have it.
So every time I watch it on Netflix, you get about 3 cents.
Yes. Everyone watch Prophecy. Forget the finale. Forget the pilot. Forget Threshold. Watch Prophecy. All you can. And those mills, those 1/10 of 1 penny coming along.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to be objective about it, just to sit there and say, here's the... Like I said, one of my criticisms is the fact that the way it wound up getting edited, the officer dynamic of the Klingons and the disease come out of the blue.
Yeah,
just structural.
Right.
Yeah. But right. that's that. Otherwise, yeah. You know, the choices of what they did to update it, and have her be in the middle while she's pregnant and married, that's, you know, they did about what they could do. Or maybe some other options, but...
Yeah. But I think it worked. They could do. Yeah, I think it worked well.
So my point is, I'll have to go with you guys' opinion here, because I have almost... Aside from thinking that, and I thought the Neelix spine actually was funny with the two different ends of it.
It was.
But, yeah. You know, it was the whole, the big Klingon woman joke. Remember Riker on the whole thing with him, with the woman eyeing him in the mess hall of the Pah, that way, way back in Matter of Honor. It's that same big scary Klingon woman want you, ha ha, thing. So,
yeah.
But it works better when she's after Neelix, though, than Riker, you know. Because, I mean, Riker's known for being a ladies' man, and Neelix isn't. So that was kind of funny. And the height difference as well.
And And now you know what Kess saw.
Somehow I don't think Kess was quite as aggressive
I took that back.
Who was that? Was that Cherega? Is that the Klingon woman who assaults Neelix, shall we say?
And escapes totally scot-free, no charges filed.
I just stroll right down the hallway at the end.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of strolling right down the... Oh, here, two little cast notes. I don't know if you looked at these. T'Greth was played by Sherman Howard, who had actually been Endar, the Talarian dad, back in Suddenly Human.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And Saevar the Vulcan in Shakar. It was on a view screen a little bit, but anyway, he'd been a couple of things. And this is the great obscure one. Ren T. Brown, who was Kolar, had been the shuttlecraft pilot in the opening of Manhunt, when Majel crowds into the... when Loxana says, "And we're looking for you!" Okay. It's like that one little view screen scene in the teaser, and that's all you see of him. And he had done that. So there's your obscure note to end on.
All right. Nice.
Nice.
All right. Well, I enjoyed Prophecy, and I certainly enjoyed the discussion today and hearing about the whole... I heard Greg joked around 45 minutes, I think, that we're getting into the show. But actually, what I was most interested in was hearing the story about how it
came about. Oh, good, because you sure took your sweet time getting around to saying that we were wasting 45 minutes. No, I'm kidding.
No, that was actually why I wanted to have you on and do this episode in the first place. So that was... I hope our listeners were as fascinated with all that as I was.
I hope so, too. But, I mean, if you guys enjoyed... everything aside, if you guys enjoyed the final episode, that's... Like I said, I've lost my ability to be totally objective. I have some basic critiques on it. But overall, without my bias one way or the other, I'm glad to hear you guys are up with it.
Yeah. So, Larry, you've got a couple of things coming up soon. At least, I know you've got one thing coming up where you're going to lead people all through the desert and show them rocks and things, right? So tell us what you have coming up.
We keep our Hollywood to Vegas tour. We keep pushing the door back. We keep getting into Germany with some advertising and into Japan. So if you're still here and you have some green stamps you can turn in... No, I'm kidding. I don't know when this is going up exactly, but... we're opening the door officially until the 15th, although people can still check in. That's just the deadline for when we can guarantee that we have hotel space in the two or three hotels we're in. But it'll probably still be fine to be after that. But that's, we go to the film sites in the 5 days before the Vegas convention, and then you're still attached through the convention with your hotel room and sites around Vegas. But we go to famous and the infamous and the obscure places around L.A. and on the road by way of Mount Whitney and Lone Pine, all on the road. So we're in the deserts, we're in the mountains, we're in urban LA, and a ton of fun. And you'll be with people that are doing the same thing. And if you've never been to Vegas before, or you've never been to LA before, you'll have some instant Trek buddies. And that's, before you ask me, that's geeknationtours.com, and look for the Hollywood to Vegas.
All right, Vegas, excellent. And I hope that still includes the Fight the Gorn portion of the package, where you're going to wear the actual Gorn suit and fight the tour participants at Vasquez Rocks, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it's still in there. Yeah, good.
For the measly sum of $300 and a month's worth of health insurance.
All right. Was there anything else coming up?
Well, just if people hear this and they're in the States, I'm going back home for a week to Oklahoma to SoonerCon this next weekend. Well, this next week, the 15th, 16th, 17th weekend. And then this sounds like such a cheesy thing now out of talk shows and things. I'm in Lake Charles, Louisiana, the end of June, 1st of July for BayouCon 3. And Bob O'Reilly and J.G. Hertz are going to be there too. And then I had a panel accepted at San Diego Comic-Con. So come with me 6 to 7 p.m., same slot I had last year. We'll do another edition of Between the Cracks, my Trekland show, with a lot of fun stuff. And I'll have some peeks at the Con of Wrath, which we're still shooting on, working along at our spare time, our documentary about this infamous Houston convention we've talked about many times. And I'll see everybody in Vegas. We'll have some special stuff coming up there, and the tour will be in Vegas, but I'll be doing my normal trivia and a panel this year. And a table and the whole bit. And then I'm going to be in El Paso for El Paso Comic-Con and Starbase Indy over the Thanksgiving weekend in Indianapolis. So I'm promoting the documentary, and we have our kind of fan-level funding there, and looking for survivors from The Ultimate Fantasy in Houston, who were there and telling their stories and all that stuff.
Well, it sounds like you've broken the warp 10 barrier and you're going to be in all cons simultaneously.
I think at this point. I'm amphibianing.
So if you'd like to see like Larry turn into
a
lizard.
Little person inside my fiberglass suit. That's sad.
All right. So it's Larry Nemechek and salamander babies all across the country coming to a city near you soon.
Or just treklandblog.com or larrynemechek.com.
Okay, that might be an easier place to go than the salamander babies. But
mere digital online bits, but oh well.
All right. Well, Larry, thanks for joining us once again on the Ready Room. It was really fascinating.
Well, thanks, guys. And I'm warning you, I did not give up all the secrets of The Making of Prophecy. It'll still be in the award-winning book. Which, you know, my book has to outsell Eric Stillwell's The Making of Yesterday's Enterprise book, because, you know, Yesterday's Enterprise ties with Best of Both Worlds for the greatest show on Next Generation, and polls have shown that Prophecy ties with the Best of Both Worlds for the greatest show on Voyager. So, you know, I have to keep something secret for the book to have it be a hit. So, just letting you know.
Well, there it was, Chris, the long-awaited Prophecy episode with actual person who worked on the show Prophecy, Larry Nemechek.
That's right. Yeah, it was very interesting to hear the background of, you know, how that story came to be and how it evolved over time. You watch these stories and, you know, so often the original pitch for a story is quite different from what we end up with on the screen. And of course, you can go to places like Memory Alpha and you can, you know, kind of read these background notes, but it's wonderful when you can actually get someone who was involved in creating the story originally in the first place to tell you firsthand, you know, all those tidbits that no one else has access to, you know, through books, because the bestseller book, The Making of Prophecy, is not yet available. But until then.
Yes. So I'm waiting to see how long it takes from the publication of this episode until Memory Alpha is going to be edited with every single tidbit put in there.
That's a good point.
Because currently it's kind of bare, but
it's a good point.
At this point, it could be quite an article.
It could be. It might be in there. All right. Well, let's tell everyone how to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on Prophecy or anything else we talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact and you can send us a message that way. It will come to us by email. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmg+. And you can always, of course, find us on Twitter at username trekfm, where we're talking about Trek all the time. And Greg, you're also on Twitter.
I am on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHAR, B as in boy, IN. You can see me, lots of Instagrams, lots of pictures of myself, lots of at replying to celebrities, hoping I get retweeted, which I did this afternoon. And I'm up to, I think, like 35 favorites, which for me is a pretty big deal. So anyway, follow me on Twitter. help me become a social media expert, as I am attempting to be.
And that's why you have the serious hat on. So,
because, yes, social media is very serious, folks.
It is serious stuff. And just to prove it's serious, you can follow me on Twitter as well. My username is CBrianJones, and that's Brian with a Y, where apparently recently I'm tweeting pictures of ourselves with giant mustaches and talking about bosom buddies a lot.
You know, you're cute when you're vague.
So, if you'd like to follow me, you can. At reply me, let me know that you followed, say hello. I tend to chat on Twitter more than I just tweet about general things. So love to have a conversation with you. So you can find us there. Of course, you can go to trek.fm to our website where you can find articles and games and wallpapers and all the different podcasts that we do. This show, MatterStream, HyperChannel, hosted by Tristan. We have Colin and Trek News and Views on there as well. All kinds of stuff for you to do. And that's over at trek.fm. And if you'd like to drop by iTunes and leave us a rating and a review, we'd appreciate it. We'd love to hear from you, and it helps people find the show. All right, Greg. Well, I think I'm going to head off. I'm going to go drop by sickbay and see if the doctor can write me a note.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a blunt batleth in it, because the ready room is done. We'll be right back.